Today is Thursday, October 22nd, and this is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, U.S. President Donald Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden hold their second and final debate tonight.
The two candidates' microphones will be muted while their opponents respond to the first question in each of the debate's six segments.
Also ahead, a push to end the conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan.
Every country should stay out. Provide no fuel for this conflict, no weapon systems, no support.
Plus, Australia opens up after COVID-19. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is in the U.S. The world will be watching closely the second and final debate between President Donald Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden tonight. There are new rules in place to avoid a chaotic debate like the first one. VOA's Carolyn Prosciutto reports from Nashville, Tennessee.
How you doing, man?
Who can forget that contentious first debate?
Would you shut up, man?
On Thursday, the candidates meet for the second and final debate. This time, when it's not the candidate's turn to respond to a question, his microphone will be muted. Both mics will be on for the freewheeling discussions that follow.
The debate takes place here in Nashville, Tennessee, a Democratic city in a state that's overwhelmingly Republican.
Nashville is a country music mecca, but now suffering from COVID restrictions. Music industry expert Eric Holt.
There hasn't been consistent live shows since March. You know, they, within the industry, the whole idea of most live venues is capacity, right? Bodies together. That's part of the live music experience. And because of COVID, we don't know when the end is. There's no hard date.
COVID is also on Tamika Johnson's mind. Because of it, she homeschools her children. She's an undecided voter who will watch the debate for answers on
the vaccines, just a lot, you know, how it will affect the children, you know, when they go back to school.
The coronavirus has changed Allie Goldsmith's mind. She voted for Donald Trump in 2016, but will walk away from him this time.
He really has not shown great leadership in terms of how he's treated the pandemic itself.
Faith is what's guiding church leader Efren Urreyes to vote for Donald Trump.
I have valued what Trump says, like abortion is committing murder. And we all have a right to life.
Trump also has Debbie Cook's vote.
Joe Biden's been up there for 40-something years and hasn't done anything. What do you think he's going to do now?
But will this final debate change any voters' minds? Not for 40 million Americans. They already voted, shattering early voting records.
I voted the second day early voting.
Bob Bernstein owns Bongo Java, the oldest coffee shop in Nashville. Biden got his vote.
Curing COVID will fix the economy. The economy is not going to fix COVID.
Both candidates will be wise to maintain composure, says Rice University political scientist Mark Jones. He says Biden needs to stay in the moment and give focused answers. His advice for Trump?
Give Biden a little more rope. Interrupt him on the softball question, but on the difficult questions, let him speak, because your only hope is that he says something during that time period that really comes back upon him.
Biden's poll numbers improved after the first debate. Trump hopes the reverse happens after Thursday's encounter. Carolyn Prosciutto, VOA News, Nashville, Tennessee.
For more on what will be discussed at tonight's debate, I reached out to VOA senior White House correspondent Patsy Whitakaswara. Patsy, normally there's a whole debate on foreign policy, but not this time, correct?
Yeah, right. And that's what's quite interesting about this last debate is that the topic slated for discussion does not include foreign policy. COVID-19 is a big one. Race in America, climate change, national security, and leadership. Those are the topics for discussion. And perhaps we can get some foreign policy questions in as part of the national security segment. But it's not really focused on foreign policy, despite the fact that President Donald Trump is really pushing for it to dominate the conversation. And the reason for this is that President Trump believes that this is the one area where he can make one of the strongest cases for his 4 years in office. He's eager to point out the military defeat of ISIS, the killing of Qasem Soleimani in Iran, ISIS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, and of course the normalization of relations between Israel and two Arab nations, United Arab Emirates and Bahrain, and the fact that he hasn't started any new wars. And in fact, his campaign chairman, Bill Stepien, sent a letter to the commission asking for an emphasis on this, but was rejected. So we'll see if President Trump will be able to get in some of the points that he wants to highlight in the debate.
Another topic that's quite important to many of our listeners is immigration. Restricting immigration was one of Trump's top campaign issues in 2016, and it's been a major feature of his presidency, with the wall on the Mexico border, reducing U.S. intake of refugees. But these policies have been extremely controversial. Can we expect immigration to be part of the debate tonight, or for Biden to try to get that in?
Yes, I mean, that's definitely something that the president also wants to highlight, right? I mean, this is, again, another one of those things that he always touts as a promise made and a promise kept, despite the fact that, you know, the wall is built, but Mexico is not paying for it, you know. So there's a lot of points that can be made either way. And I think this is also a chance for Joe Biden to highlight that his immigration policy will be, A, according to them, more comprehensive, and then B, more compassionate. So we'll see if we can get in any of those topics. Again, it might be part of the whole national security segment. But this is a 90-minute debate, and we'll see how much substance we can get into it, especially with the changes in the new rules.
Yeah, and let's talk about some of those changes. The first debate was chaotic and contentious. Accounts by the Washington Post found the candidates interrupted each other or the moderator 90 times in the 90-minute debate. 71 of those interruptions were from Trump.
Correct.
Meanwhile, Biden at one point told Trump to shut up. They're muting the mics this time, but how is that going to work? What can we expect tonight?
Right, so the two candidates' microphones will be muted while their opponents respond to the first question in each of the debate's six segments. Having said that, it doesn't mean that, you know, they have like a gag over their mouth and they can't respond. It's just that their microphones will be muted. And if they do respond and if they interject or interrupt in a loud voice, then it may still be picked up by their opponent's microphone. And that may be a technique that President Trump might want to try again on his opponent, just to interrupt and basically disrupt his train of thought. So we'll see if that will happen. There's really no way of controlling that. And then after the opening part of each segment, then both candidates' mics will be open, and it will be up to the moderator to be able to guide the process.
That was VOA senior White House correspondent Patsy Whitakaswara. As the November 3rd election nears, former President Barack Obama made his first in-person campaign pitch Wednesday for his former Vice President Joe Biden. AP's Sagar Magani reports.
Former President Obama has lit into his successor in urging voters to back his former vice president. Obama says President Trump has treated the office like a reality show, just another way to get attention.
This is not a reality show, this is reality. And the rest of us have had to live with the consequences of him proving himself incapable of taking the job seriously.
Outside the Phillies ballpark in Philadelphia, the former president targeted disillusioned voters with a reminder that America is a good and decent place.
That decency, that belief that everybody counts, that's who Joe is.
Saying Biden and Kamala Harris can lead the nation out of dark times. Sagar Magani, Washington.
In Ukraine, people are closely following the U.S. presidential election, given America's strategic importance to the country and campaign allegations of corruption linked to Ukraine. Henry Ridgewell has that story.
United States Armed Forces taking part in Exercise Fiction Urchin alongside Ukrainian Special Forces west of Kiev last month. The U.S. has significantly bolstered defense ties since Russia's 2014 invasion of Crimea and eastern Ukraine. A U.S. Special Operations Forces major, whose name was withheld for security reasons, explained the aim of the exercise.
So with the ongoing conflict in the east, I think we can do what we're doing now. It's partnering with Ukraine, working together, showing them, as well as NATO and the other Western allies, that we're here, we stand beside Ukraine.
It is that American military support that resonates most with Ukrainian people as they watch the U.S. election unfold, says political analyst Alexei Arestovich.
What's important to them is that the U.S. does not stop its military support.
In the first months of Donald Trump's presidency, Arestovich says there were concerns in Ukraine over the closeness of the relationship with his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin.
However, it became clear that no matter how much Trump complimented Putin with words, in reality, the military activity has been increasing and the safety umbrella has been growing over Eastern Europe and Ukraine, together with the military support. So the collective opinion has changed.
Allegations that Donald Trump threatened to withhold military aid to Ukraine unless Kiev launched an investigation into his Democrat rival Joe Biden were at the center of the president's impeachment by the House of Representatives in 2019. He was later acquitted in the Senate. Ukraine is back in the political spotlight amid renewed Republican claims that, as vice president in 2015, Joe Biden shielded his son, Hunter Biden, who was then on the board of a Ukrainian energy firm, from an anti-corruption investigation by demanding the dismissal of Ukraine's chief prosecutor. The Bidens strongly deny the claim and accuse Republicans of a smear campaign. The FBI is investigating possible Russian disinformation. Most Ukrainians are uncomfortable with their country's involvement in the election campaign, says Arestovich.
The collective wish of the ordinary Ukrainian is that we do not meddle in any American politics, and that we would be friends with the Americans militarily. The military safety umbrella, that's the main interest, protection from Russia.
Ukrainians who spoke to VOA largely echoed that view.
We have our own independent country, and there is no sense in arguing or fighting with our neighbors and friends.
I think Biden is better for Ukrainians, but my American friends are closer to Trump.
Well, both of them supported us, so Ukraine shouldn't lose out either way. I personally think we have already experienced Trump, so we hope for the best with Biden.
I think there will be no significant changes in Ukraine, no matter who wins the elections.
Analysts say Ukrainians' greatest hope is that U.S. military support continues after the election, no matter who wins. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News.
U.S. intelligence agencies have accused Iran and Russia of trying to sow chaos and confusion in the U.S. ahead of the election. At a news conference Wednesday, National Intelligence Director John Ratcliffe did not explain how Russia was doing so, but he said Iranian cyber actors are behind a flurry of emails sent to potential voters over the previous 24 hours, some of which he said appeared to be designed to hurt U.S. President Donald Trump. The emails appeared to come from the Proud Boys, a far-right group that has rallied behind Trump. The emails apparently targeted mostly registered Democrats in at least four states, Arizona, Alaska, Pennsylvania, and Florida. The voters were told, quote, "You will vote for Trump on Election Day or we will come for you," end quote. Iran's foreign ministry said the accusations were baseless. Representatives of the Proud Boys denied involvement. This is VOA. Rights group Amnesty International says at least 56 Nigerian protesters have been killed in clashes with security forces during weeks-long demonstrations against police brutality. The group says at least 38 people died on Tuesday, 12 of them when security forces opened fire on unarmed protesters who gathered in Nigeria's capital, Lagos. Authorities have admitted some casualties but downplayed the numbers, while Nigeria's army denied firing on protesters. The African Union today joined a chorus of condemnation of the violence, which included protests in South Africa, the United States, and London. The United Nations, United States, European Union, and Britain have all called for the perpetrators of the killings to be held responsible. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo on Thursday strongly condemned, quote, "excessive force by military forces who fired on unarmed demonstrators," end quote. UN Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet says she is concerned about reports that closed-circuit TV cameras and lighting were deliberately disabled prior to Tuesday's shooting in Lagos. Thailand today rolled back an emergency decree that aims to shut down months of protests against the government and the monarchy. When the decree took effect 1 week ago, it inflamed demonstrations rather than reducing them, as tens of thousands spilled onto the streets of Bangkok. As of 12 p.m. local time today, the measures that include bans on political gatherings of five people or more and publishing of news that could affect security will be lifted. But Reuters reports that protesters said withdrawing the measures was not enough. They have given Prime Minister Prayut Chan-o-Cha a 3-day deadline to resign. You are listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Global leaders are pushing for an end to the fighting between Armenia and Azerbaijan over the disputed territory of Nagorno-Karabakh, but Armenia's prime minister said Wednesday he sees no possibility of a diplomatic solution at this stage of the conflict. VOA's diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
Azerbaijan's defense ministry shared video. It says shows Azeri artillery bombarding positions of Armenian armed forces over the disputed mountain territory of Nagorno-Karabakh. Several hundred people have been killed since the fiercest fighting in decades broke out on September 27th, sparking fears of a humanitarian crisis. On Wednesday, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo joined other global leaders in pushing for an end to the conflict.
And our view remains, as does the view of nearly every European country, that the right path forward is to cease the conflict, tell them to de-escalate, that every country should stay out, provide no fuel for this conflict, no weapon systems, no support. And it is at that point that a diplomatic solution that would be acceptable to all can potentially be achieved.
Pompeo has invited the foreign ministers of both Armenia and Azerbaijan to meet with him separately at the State Department Friday, and said he is anxious to hear what they are seeing on the ground. But Armenia's prime minister dampened any hopes of a diplomatic breakthrough in a Facebook address to the nation Wednesday. Armenian Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan.
We should realize that Nagorno-Karabakh conflict, at least in this stage, and starting from this stage for a long time, is no diplomatic solution.
For his part, Azerbaijani President Ilham Aliyev has said that to end the fighting, Armenian forces must withdraw from Nagorno-Karabakh. Also Wednesday, Turkey said it will not hesitate to send troops and provide military support to help Azerbaijan if such a request is made. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
As Australia's most populous state eases more COVID-19 restrictions, experts are praising the nation's response to the virus. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Life in much of Australia is beginning to resemble what it was before COVID-19. On Friday, more restrictions will be relaxed in the state of New South Wales. Places of worship will be allowed to have up to 300 people, while the capacity of gyms will also increase. 40,000 sports fans are expected to attend the final of the National Rugby League competition in Sydney on Sunday. Across Australia, a nation of 25 million people, there is cautious optimism that for now at least, the coronavirus is being contained. More than 27,400 COVID-19 cases and 900 deaths have been recorded since it was first detected in Australia in late January. 8.3 million tests have been carried out. Federal Health Minister Greg Hunt says that the closure of Australia's borders to foreign travellers in March has also been critical.
What we've seen is that around the country we've done incredibly well, and there are four defences: our international borders, testing, which has been uniformly good around all of the states and territories, tracing, which has overwhelmingly been outstanding, with New South Wales the gold standard. Victoria had real challenges, but it's improving, and I think that's a very important message.
International travel into and out of Australia is expected to remain restricted well into next year, although a so-called safe travel bubble is allowing New Zealanders to fly into New South Wales and the Northern Territory. Many Australians have watched on in disbelief and concern for family and friends as coronavirus cases surge again in other parts of the world. Raina McIntyre, a professor of biosecurity at the University of New South Wales Kirby Institute, says the situation in the United States and United Kingdom is horrifying.
It's just thoroughly shocking. When we think of pandemics, we don't think that well-resourced, high-income countries are going to fall apart at the seams. But that's exactly what we've seen.
Some of the world's toughest lockdown measures in the city of Melbourne could be eased next week, as reported infections continue to fall. The Victorian state capital has been at the centre of Australia's COVID-19 emergency, but authorities are hopeful strict stay-at-home orders and other measures imposed for more than 100 days have worked. However, clusters of the disease continue to cause alarm. Health officials have sent text messages to about 140,000 people living in three Melbourne suburbs, urging them to be tested after a student attended school while infectious with COVID-19. Australian officials concede that while the virus is mostly contained, success will only be celebrated when a safe and reliable global vaccine is available. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
That's it for our show today. On behalf of our producer Nadia Taha and our managing editor Kate Pound Dawson, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great evening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
I have never been more optimistic regarding the future possibilities of the India-U.S. relationship, said U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Stephen Biegun at the U.S.-India Forum. The U.S.-India relationship covers many areas, including, among others, defense and security cooperation, mutual law enforcement support, trade and investment ties, energy partnership, and scientific and technological collaboration. Of particular significance are the joint efforts by American and Indian universities and companies to conduct coronavirus vaccine trials. Deputy Secretary Biegun expressed the need for updated security alliances in the Indo-Pacific region. The United States cannot assume that a global post-World War II alliance structure designed to address the challenges and threats of the Cold War can endure without rejuvenation, said Deputy Secretary Biegun. To sustain the free and open order, our strategic relationships need to reflect the geopolitical realities of today and tomorrow. Under an updated security partnership, nations like India would seek to provide for their own defense, explained Deputy Secretary Biegun. In this context, the United States is looking for ways to empower India's ability to defend its own sovereignty and democracy and to advance Indian interests across the Indo-Pacific region. The United States and India, together with Japan and Australia, are four democratic anchors in an Indo-Pacific, sharing values as well as common interests. Together, we stand for a pluralistic vision that will ensure that our countries and all the region's diverse countries can thrive as sovereign and prosperous nations in a free and open Indo-Pacific, said Deputy Secretary Biegun. But he warned that this vision is not a foregone conclusion in light of China's aggressive tactics in the region. The threat posed by China will require cooperation bilaterally with India and with others to build up the security of nations in the Indo-Pacific, said Deputy Secretary Biegun. The United States has already begun to increase foreign military sales and intelligence sharing with India. But there is more to be done, including strengthening India's ability to defend itself by promoting interoperability among both militaries through regular exercises and exchanges, common defense platforms, and co-development. Our two nations are destined for great things, declared Deputy Secretary.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Batty, host of your breakfast show, Daybreak Africa. As always, our newsroom is on top of the news of your interest. We provide you with up-to-the-minute news about Africa as well as world news. Tune in to our show right here on VOA Africa, your trusted source of news and information.
Terry Began, it is up to us to accelerate the momentum.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.